the kindness to take wider steps, you would preserve your equilibrium better. Arrived at the upper ridge of the promontory, I saw a vast white plain covered with morses. They were playing amongst themselves, and what we heard were bellowings of pleasure, not of anger. As I passed these curious animals, I could examine them leisurely, for they did not move. Their skins were thick and rugged, of a yellowish tint, approaching to red. Their hair was short and scant. Some of them were 4 yards and a quarter long. Quieter and less timid than their cousins of the north, they did not, like them, place sentinels round the outskirts of their encampment. After examining this city of morses, I began to think of returning. It was 11 o'clock, and if Captain Nemo found the conditions favorable for observations, I wished to be present at the operation. We followed a narrow pathway running along the summit of the steep shore. At 11:30 we had reached the place where we landed. The boat had run aground, bringing the captain. I saw him standing on a block of basalt, his instruments near him, his eyes fixed on the northern horizon, near which the sun was then describing a lengthened curve. I took my place beside him and waited without speaking. Noon arrived, and as before, the sun did not appear. It was a fatality. Observations were still wanting. If not accomplished tomorrow, we must give up all idea of taking any. We were indeed exactly at the 20th of March. Tomorrow, the 21st, would be the equinox. The sun would disappear behind the horizon for 6 months, and with its disappearance the long polar night would begin. Since the September equinox, it had emerged from the northern horizon, rising by lengthened spirals up to the 21st of December. At this period, the summer solstice of the northern regions, it had begun to descend, and tomorrow was to shed its last rays upon them. I communicated my fears and observations to Captain Nemo. "You are right, Monsieur Aronnax," said he. "If tomorrow I cannot take the altitude of the sun, I shall not be able to do it for 6 months. But precisely because chance has led me into these seas on the 21st of March, my bearings will be easy to take, if at 12 we can see the sun."
"Why, Captain?"
"Because then the orb of day describes such lengthened curves that it is difficult to measure exactly its height above the horizon, and grave errors may be made with instruments."
"What will you do then?"
"I shall only use my chronometer," replied Captain Nemo. "If tomorrow, the 21st of March, the disk of the sun, allowing for refraction, is exactly cut by the northern horizon, it will show that I am at the South Pole."
"Just so," said I. "But this statement is not mathematically correct, because the equinox does not necessarily begin at noon."
"Very likely, sir. But the error will not be 100 yards, and we do not want more. Till tomorrow, then."
Captain Nemo returned on board. Conseil and I remained to survey the shore, observing and studying until 5 o'clock. Then I went to bed, not, however, without invoking, like the Indian, the favor of the radiant orb. The next day, the 21st of March, at 5 in the morning, I mounted the platform. I found Captain Nemo there.
"The weather is lightening a little," said he. "I have some hope. After breakfast we will go on shore and choose a post for observation."
That point settled, I sought Ned Land. I wanted to take him with me. But the obstinate Canadian refused, and I saw that his taciturnity and his bad humor grew day by day. After all, I was not sorry for his obstinacy under the circumstances. Indeed, there were too many seals on shore, and we ought not to lay such temptation in this unreflecting fisherman's way. Breakfast over, we went on shore. The Nautilus had gone some miles further up in the night. It was a whole league from the coast, above which reared a sharp peak about 500 yards high. The boat took with me Captain Nemo, 2 men of the crew, and the instruments, which consisted of a chronometer, a telescope, and a barometer. While crossing, I saw numerous whales belonging to the three kinds peculiar to the southern seas. The whale, or the English right whale, which has no dorsal fin, the humpback, with reeved chest and large whitish fins, which, in spite of its name, do not form wings, and the finback, of a yellowish brown, the liveliest of all the cetacea. This powerful creature is heard a long way off when he throws to a great height columns of air and vapor, which look like whirlwinds of smoke. These different mammals were disporting themselves in troops in the quiet waters, and I could see that this basin of the Antarctic Pole serves as a place of refuge to the cetacea too closely tracked by the hunters. I also noticed large medusae floating between the reeds. At 9 we landed. The sky was brightening, the clouds were flying to the south, and the fog seemed to be leaving the cold surface of the waters. Captain Nemo went towards the peak, which he doubtless meant to be his observatory. It was a painful ascent over the sharp lava and the pumice stones, in an atmosphere often impregnated with a sulphurous smell from the smoking cracks. For a man unaccustomed to walk on land, the captain climbed the steep slopes with an agility I never saw equaled, and which a hunter would have envied. We were 2 hours getting to the summit of this peak, which was half porphyry and half basalt. From thence we looked upon a vast sea, which, towards the north, distinctly traced its boundary line upon the sky. At our feet lay fields of dazzling whiteness. Over our heads a pale azure, free from fog. To the north, the disk of the sun seemed like a ball of fire, already horned by the cutting of the horizon. From the bosom of the water rose sheaves of liquid jets by hundreds. In the distance lay the Nautilus like a cetacean asleep on the water. Behind us, to the south and east, an immense country and a chaotic heap of rocks and ice, the limits of which were not visible. On arriving at the summit, Captain Nemo carefully took the mean height of the barometer, for he would have to consider that in taking his observations. At 11:45 the sun, then seen only by refraction, looked like a golden disk shedding its last rays upon this deserted continent and seas which never man had yet ploughed. Captain Nemo, furnished with a lenticular glass, which, by means of a mirror, corrected the refraction, watched the orb sinking below the horizon by degrees, following a lengthened diagonal. I held the chronometer. My heart beat fast. If the disappearance of the half-disk of the sun coincided with 12 o'clock on the chronometer, we were at the pole itself. 12, I exclaimed.
The South Pole, replied Captain Nemo, in a grave voice, handing me the glass, which showed the orb cut in exactly equal parts by the horizon.
I looked at the last rays crowning the peak, and the shadows mounting by degrees up its slopes. At that moment, Captain Nemo, resting with his hand on my shoulder, said,
I, Captain Nemo, on this 21st day of March, 1868, have reached the South Pole on the 90th degree, and I take possession of this part of the globe, equal to 1/6 of the known continents.
In whose name, Captain?
In my own, sir.
Saying which, Captain Nemo unfurled a black banner, bearing an N in gold quartered on its bunting. Then, turning towards the orb of day, whose last rays lapped the horizon of the sea, he exclaimed,
Adieu, sun! Disappear, thou radiant orb! Rest beneath this open sea, and let a night of 6 months spread its shadows over my new domains.
Chapter 15. Accident or Incident. The next day, the 22nd of March, at 6 in the morning, preparations for departure were begun. The last gleams of twilight were melting into night. The cold was great. The constellations shone with wonderful intensity. In the zenith glittered that wondrous southern cross, the polar bear of Antarctic regions. The thermometer showed 120 below zero, and when the wind freshened it was most biting. Flakes of ice increased on the open water. The sea seemed everywhere alike. Numerous blackish patches spread on the surface, showing the formation of fresh ice, Evidently the southern basin, frozen during the 6 winter months, was absolutely inaccessible. What became of the whales in that time? Doubtless they went beneath the icebergs, seeking more practicable seas. As to the seals and morses, accustomed to live in a hard climate, they remained on these icy shores. These creatures have the instinct to break holes in the ice field and to keep them open. To these holes they come for breath. When the birds, driven away by the cold, have emigrated to the north, these sea mammals remain sole masters of the polar continent. But the reservoirs were filling with water, and the Nautilus was slowly descending. At 1,000 feet deep, it stopped. Its screw beat the waves, and it advanced straight towards the north at a speed of 15 miles an hour. Towards night, it was already floating under the immense body of the iceberg. At 3 in the morning, I was awakened by a violent shock. I sat up in my bed and listened in the darkness, when I was thrown into the middle of the room. The Nautilus, after having struck, had rebounded violently. I groped along the partition and by the staircase to the saloon, which was lit by the luminous ceiling. The furniture was upset. Fortunately, the windows were firmly set and had held fast. The pictures on the starboard side, from being no longer vertical, were clinging to the paper, whilst those of the port side were hanging at least a foot from the wall. The Nautilus was lying on its starboard side perfectly motionless. I heard footsteps and a confusion of voices, but Captain Nemo did not appear. As I was leaving the saloon, Ned Land and Conseil entered. "What is the matter?" said I at once.
"I came to ask you, sir," replied Conseil.
"Confound it!" exclaimed the Canadian. "I know well enough. The Nautilus has struck, and judging by the way she lies, I do not think she will right herself as she did the first time in Torres Straits." "But," I asked, "has she at least come to the surface of the sea?"
"We do not know," said Conseil.
"It is easy to decide," I answered. I consulted the manometer. To my great surprise, it showed a depth of more than 180 fathoms.
"What does that mean?" I exclaimed.
"We must ask Captain Nemo," said Conseil.
"But where shall we find him?" said Ned Land.
"Follow me," said I to my companions. We left the saloon. There was no one in the library. At the center staircase, by the berths of the ship's crew, there was no one. I thought that Captain Nemo must be in the pilot's cage. It was best to wait. We all returned to the saloon. For 20 minutes we remained thus, trying to hear the slightest noise which might be made on board the Nautilus, when Captain Nemo entered. He seemed not to see us. His face, generally so impassive, showed signs of uneasiness. He watched the compass silently, then the manometer, and, going to the planisphere, placed his finger on a spot representing the southern seas. I would not interrupt him. But some minutes later, when he turned towards me, I said, using one of his own expressions in the Torres Straits,
"An incident, Captain?"
"No, sir, an accident this time."
"Serious?"
"Perhaps."
"Is the danger immediate?"
"No."
"The Nautilus has stranded?"
"Yes."
"And this has happened?"
"How?"
"From a caprice of nature, not from the ignorance of man. Not a mistake has been made in the working. But we cannot prevent equilibrium from producing its effects. We may brave human laws, but we cannot resist natural ones."
Captain Nemo had chosen a strange moment for uttering this philosophical reflection. On the whole, his answer helped me little.
"May I ask, sir, the cause of this accident?"
"An enormous block of ice. A whole mountain has turned over," he replied. "When icebergs are undermined at their base by warmer water or reiterated shocks, their center of gravity rises, and the whole thing turns over. This is what has happened. One of these blocks, as it fell, struck the Nautilus, then, gliding under its hull, raised it with irresistible force, bringing it into beds which are not so thick, where it is lying on its side. But can we not get the Nautilus off by emptying its reservoirs, that it might regain its equilibrium?
That, sir, is being done at this moment. You can hear the pump working. Look at the needle of the manometer. It shows that the Nautilus is rising, but the block of ice is floating with it. And until some obstacle stops its ascending motion, our position cannot be altered.
Indeed, the Nautilus still held the same position to starboard. Doubtless it would right itself when the block stopped.
But at this moment, who knows if we may not be frightfully crushed between the two glassy surfaces? I reflected on all the consequences of our position.
Captain Nemo never took his eyes off the manometer.
Since the fall of the iceberg, the Nautilus had risen about 150 feet, but it still made the same angle with the perpendicular. Suddenly a slight movement was felt in the hold. Evidently it was righting a little. Things hanging in the saloon were sensibly returning to their normal position. The partitions were nearing the upright. No one spoke. With beating hearts we watched and felt the straightening. The boards became horizontal under our feet. 10 minutes passed.
"At last we have righted," I exclaimed.
"Yes," said Captain Nemo, going to the door of the saloon.
"But are we floating?" I asked.
"Certainly," he replied, "since the reservoirs are not empty, and when empty the Nautilus must rise to the surface of the sea." We were in open sea, but at a distance of about 10 yards, on either side of the Nautilus, rose a dazzling wall of ice. Above and beneath the same wall. Above, because the lower surface of the iceberg stretched over us like an immense ceiling. Beneath, because the overturned block, having slid by degrees, had found a resting place on the lateral walls, which kept it in that position. The Nautilus was really imprisoned in a perfect tunnel of ice, more than 20 yards in breadth, filled with quiet water. It was easy to get out of it by going either forward or backward, and then make a free passage under the iceberg, some hundreds of yards deeper. The luminous ceiling had been extinguished, but the saloon was still resplendent with intense light. It was the powerful reflection from the glass partition sent violently back to the sheets of the lantern. I cannot describe the effect of the voltaic rays upon the great blocks so capriciously cut. Upon every angle, every ridge, every facet was thrown a different light, according to the nature of the veins running through the ice. A dazzling mine of gems, particularly of sapphires, their blue rays crossing with the green of the emerald. Here and there were opal shades of wonderful softness, running through bright spots like diamonds of fire, the brilliancy of which the eye could not bear. The power of the lantern seemed increased 100-fold, like a lamp through the lenticular plates of a first-class lighthouse.
"How beautiful! How beautiful!" cried Conseil.
"Yes," I said, "it is a wonderful sight, is it not, Ned?"
"Yes, confound it, yes," answered Ned Land. "It is superb. I am mad at being obliged to admit it. No one has ever seen anything like it, but the sight may cost us dear. And if I must say all, I think we are seeing here things which God never intended man to see."
Ned was right. It was too beautiful. Suddenly a cry from Conseil made me turn.
"What is it?" I asked. "Shut your eyes, sir. Do not look, sir."
Saying which, Conseil clapped his hands over his eyes.
"But what is the matter, my boy?"
"I am dazzled. Blinded."
My eyes turned involuntarily towards the glass, but I could not stand the fire which seemed to devour them. I understood what had happened. The Nautilus had put on full speed. All the quiet luster of the ice walls was at once changed into flashes of lightning. The fire from these myriads of diamonds was blinding. It required some time to calm our troubled looks. At last the hands were taken down.
"Faith, I should never have believed it," said Conseil.
It was then 5 in the morning, and at that moment a shock was felt at the bows of the Nautilus. I knew that its spur had struck a block of ice. It must have been a false maneuver, for this submarine tunnel, obstructed by blocks, was not very easy navigation. I thought that Captain Nemo, by changing his course, would either turn these obstacles or else follow the windings of the tunnel. In any case, the road before us could not be entirely blocked. But, contrary to my expectations, the Nautilus took a decided retrograde motion.
"We are going backwards?" said Conseil.
"Yes," I replied. "This end of the tunnel can have no egress."
"And then?"
"Then," I said, "the working is easy. We must go back again and go out at the southern opening, that is all." In speaking thus, I wished to appear more confident than I really was. But the retrograde motion of the Nautilus was increasing, and reversing the screw it carried us at great speed.
"It will be a hindrance," said Ned.
"What does it matter? Some hours more or less, provided we get out at last."
"Yes," repeated Ned Land, "provided we do get out at last."
For a short time I walked from the saloon to the library. My companions were silent. I soon threw myself on an ottoman and took a book, which my eyes overran mechanically. A quarter of an hour after, Conseil, approaching me, said,
"Is what you are reading very interesting, sir?"
"Very interesting," I replied.
"I should think so, sir.
It is your own book you are reading."
"My book?"
And indeed I was holding in my hand the work on the great submarine depths. I did not even dream of it. I closed the book and returned to my walk. Ned and Conseil rose to go.
"Stay here, my friends," said I, detaining them.
"Let us remain together until we are out of this block."
"As you please, sir," Conseil replied.
Some hours passed. I often looked at the instruments hanging from the partition. The manometer showed that the Nautilus kept at a constant depth of more than 300 yards. The compass still pointed to south. The log indicated a speed of 20 miles an hour, which, in such a cramped space, was very great. But Captain Nemo knew that he could not hasten too much, and that minutes were worth ages to us. At 8:25, a second shock took place, this time from behind. I turned pale. My companions were close by my side. I seized Conseil's hand. Our looks expressed our feelings better than words. At this moment the captain entered the saloon. I went up to him.
"Our course is barred, Southard?" I asked.
"Yes, sir, the iceberg has shifted and closed every outlet."
"We are blocked up, then?"
"Yes."
Chapter 16. Want of Air. Thus, around the Nautilus, above and below, was an impenetrable wall of ice. We were prisoners to the iceberg. I watched the captain. His countenance had resumed its habitual imperturbability. "Gentlemen," he said calmly, "there are two ways of dying in the circumstances in which we are placed." This puzzling person had the air of a mathematical professor lecturing to his pupils. "The first is to be crushed. The second is to die of suffocation. I do not speak of the possibility of dying of hunger, for the supply of provisions in the Nautilus will certainly last longer than we shall. Let us then calculate our chances." "As to suffocation, Captain," I replied, "that is not to be feared, because our reservoirs are full." "Just so. But they will only yield 2 days' supply of air. Now for 36 hours we have been hidden under the water, and already the heavy atmosphere of the Nautilus requires renewal. In 48 hours our reserve will be exhausted."
"Well, Captain, can we be delivered before 48 hours?
"We will attempt it, at least, by piercing the wall that surrounds us."
"On which side?"
"Sound will tell us. I am going to run the Nautilus aground on the lower bank, and my men will attack the iceberg on the side that is least thick." Captain Nemo went out. Soon I discovered by a hissing noise that the water was entering the reservoirs. The Nautilus sank slowly, and rested on the ice at a depth of 350 yards, the depth at which the lower bank was immersed. "My friends," I said, "our situation is serious, but I rely on your courage and energy." "Sir," replied the Canadian, "I am ready to do anything for the general safety."
"Good, Ned."
And I held out my hand to the Canadian. "I will add," he continued, "that being as handy with the pickaxe as with the harpoon, if I can be useful to the captain, he can command my services."
"He will not refuse your help. Come, Ned."
I led him to the room where the crew of the Nautilus were putting on their cork jackets. I told the captain of Ned's proposal, which he accepted. The Canadian put on his sea costume and was ready as soon as his companions. When Ned was dressed, I re-entered the drawing room, where the panes of glass were open, and, posted near Conseil, I examined the ambient beds that supported the Nautilus. Some instants after, we saw a dozen of the crew set foot on the bank of ice, and among them Ned Land, easily known by his stature. Captain Nemo was with them. Before proceeding to dig the walls, he took the soundings, to be sure of working in the right direction. Long sounding lines were sunk in the side walls, but after 15 yards they were again stopped by the thick wall. It was useless to attack it on the ceiling-like surface, since the iceberg itself measured more than 400 yards in height. Captain Nemo then sounded the lower surface. There 10 yards of wall separated us from the water, so great was the thickness of the ice field. It was necessary, therefore, to cut from it a piece equal in extent to the waterline of the Nautilus. There were about 6,000 cubic yards to detach, so as to dig a hole by which we could descend to the ice field. The work had begun immediately, and carried on with indefatigable energy. Instead of digging round the Nautilus, which would have involved greater difficulty, Captain Nemo had an immense trench made at 8 yards from the port quarter. Then the men set to work simultaneously with their screws on several points of its circumference. Presently the pickaxe attacked this compact matter vigorously, and large blocks were detached from the mass. By a curious effect of specific gravity, these blocks, lighter than water, fled, so to speak, to the vault of the tunnel, that increased in thickness at the top in proportion as it diminished at the base. But that mattered little so long as the lower part grew thinner. After 2 hours' hard work, Ned Land came in exhausted. He and his comrades were replaced by new workers, whom Conseil and I joined. The second lieutenant of the Nautilus superintended us. The water seemed singularly cold, but I soon got warm handling the pickaxe. My movements were free enough, although they were made under a pressure of 30 atmospheres. When I re-entered after working 2 hours to take some food and rest, I found a perceptible difference between the pure fluid with which the Rouquayrol engine supplied me and the atmosphere of the Nautilus, already charged with carbonic acid. The air had not been renewed for 48 hours, and its vivifying qualities were considerably enfeebled. However, after a lapse of 12 hours, we had only raised a block of ice 1 yard thick on the marked surface, which was about 600 cubic yards. Reckoning that it took 12 hours to accomplish this much, it would take 5 nights and 4 days to bring this enterprise to a satisfactory conclusion. 5 nights and 4 days. And we have only air enough for 2 days in the reservoirs. "Without taking into account," said Ned, "that even if we get out of this infernal prison, we shall also be imprisoned under the iceberg, shut out from all possible communication with the atmosphere."
True enough.
Who could then foresee the minimum of time necessary for our deliverance? We might be suffocated before the Nautilus could regain the surface of the waves. Was it destined to perish in this ice tomb with all those it enclosed? The situation was terrible. But everyone had looked the danger in the face, and each was determined to do his duty to the last. As I expected, during the night a new block a yard square was carried away, and still further sank the immense hollow. But in the morning, when, dressed in my cork jacket, I traversed the slushy mass at a temperature of 6 or 7 degrees below zero, I remarked that the side walls were gradually closing in. The beds of water farthest from the trench, that were not warmed by the men's work, showed a tendency to solidification. In presence of this new and imminent danger, what would become of our chances of safety? And how hinder the solidification of this liquid medium that would burst the partitions of the Nautilus like glass? I did not tell my companions of this new danger. What was the good of damping the energy they displayed in the painful work of escape? But when I went on board again, I told Captain Nemo of this grave complication. "I know it," he said, in that calm tone which could counteract the most terrible apprehensions. "It is one danger more. But I see no way of escaping it. The only chance of safety is to go quicker than solidification. We must be beforehand with it, that is all." On this day for several hours I used my pickaxe vigorously. The work kept me up. Besides, to work was to quit the Nautilus, and breathe directly the pure air drawn from the reservoirs, and supplied by our apparatus, and to quit the impoverished and vitiated atmosphere. Towards evening the trench was dug 1 yard deeper. When I returned on board I was nearly suffocated by the carbonic acid with which the air was filled. Ah, if we had only the chemical means to drive away this deleterious gas! We had plenty of oxygen. All this water contained a considerable quantity, and by dissolving it with our powerful piles it would restore the vivifying fluid. I had thought well over it. But of what good was that, since the carbonic acid produced by our respiration had invaded every part of the vessel? To absorb it, it was necessary to fill some jars with caustic potash, and to shake them incessantly. Now this substance was wanting on board, and nothing could replace it. On that evening, Captain Nemo ought to open the taps of his reservoirs and let some pure air into the interior of the Nautilus. Without this precaution, we could not get rid of the sense of suffocation. The next day, March 26th, I resumed my miner's work in beginning the 5th yard. The side walls and the lower surface of the iceberg thickened visibly. It was evident that they would meet before the Nautilus was able to disengage itself. Despair seized me for an instant. My pickaxe nearly fell from my hands. What was the good of digging if I must be suffocated, crushed by the water that was turning into stone? A punishment that the ferocity of the savages even would not have invented. Just then Captain Nemo passed near me. I touched his hand and showed him the walls of our prison. The wall to port had advanced to at least 4 yards from the hull of the Nautilus. The captain understood me, and signed me to follow him. We went on board. I took off my cork jacket and accompanied him into the drawing room. "Monsieur Aronnax, we must attempt some desperate means, or we shall be sealed up in this solidified water as in cement."
"Yes, but what is to be done?"
"Ah, if my Nautilus were strong enough to bear this pressure without being crushed."
"Well?"
I asked, not catching the captain's idea. "Do you not understand," he replied, "that this congelation of water will help us? Do you not see that by its solidification it would burst through this field of ice that imprisons us, as when it freezes it bursts the hardest stones? Do you not perceive that it would be an agent of safety instead of destruction?"
"Yes, Captain, perhaps. But
whatever resistance to crushing the Nautilus possesses, it could not support this terrible pressure, and would be flattened like an iron plate."
"I know it, sir.
Therefore we must not reckon on the aid of nature, but on our own exertions. We must stop this solidification. Not only will the side walls be pressed together, but there is not 10 feet of water before or behind the Nautilus. The congelation gains on us on all sides."
"How long will the air in the reservoirs last for us to breathe on board?"
The captain looked in my face. "After tomorrow, they will be empty." A cold sweat came over me. However, ought I to have been astonished at the answer? On March 22nd the Nautilus was in the open polar seas. We were at 26 degrees. For 5 days we had lived on the reservoir on board. And what was left of the respirable air must be kept for the workers. Even now, as I write, my recollection is still so vivid that an involuntary terror seizes me, and my lungs seem to be without air. Meanwhile, Captain Nemo reflected silently, and evidently an idea had struck him. But he seemed to reject it. At last, these words escaped his lips. "Boiling water," he muttered.
"Boiling water?" I cried.
"Yes, sir. We are enclosed in a space that is relatively confined. Would not jets of boiling water, constantly injected by the pumps, raise the temperature in this part and stay the congelation?"
"Let us try it," I said resolutely.
"Let us try it, Professor." The thermometer then stood at 7 degrees outside. Captain Nemo took me to the galleys where the vast distillatory machine stood that furnished the drinkable water by evaporation. They filled these with water, and all the electric heat from the piles was thrown through the worms bathed in the liquid. In a few minutes, this water reached 100 degrees. It was directed towards the pumps, while fresh water replaced it in proportion. The heat developed by the troughs was such that cold water, drawn up from the sea after only having gone through the machines, came boiling into the body of the pump. The injection was begun, and 3 hours after, the thermometer marked 6 degrees below zero outside. 1 degree was gained. 2 hours later, the thermometer only marked 4 degrees.
"We shall succeed," I said to the captain, after having anxiously watched the result of the operation.
"I think," he answered, "that we shall not be crushed. We have no more suffocation to fear." During the night, the temperature of the water rose to 1 degree below zero. The injections could not carry it to a higher point. But as the congelation of the seawater produces at least 2 degrees, I was at least reassured against the dangers of solidification. The next day, March 27th, 6 yards of ice had been cleared, 12 feet only remaining to be cleared away. There was yet 48 hours' work. The air could not be renewed in the interior of the Nautilus, and this day would make it worse. An intolerable weight oppressed me. Towards 3 o'clock in the evening, this feeling rose to a violent degree. Yawns dislocated my jaws. My lungs panted as they inhaled this burning fluid, which became rarefied more and more. A moral torpor took hold of me. I was powerless, almost unconscious. My brave Conseil, though exhibiting the same symptoms and suffering in the same manner, never left me. He took my hand and encouraged me, and I heard him murmur, "Oh, if I could only not breathe so as to leave more air for my master." Tears came into my eyes on hearing him speak thus. If our situation to all was intolerable in the interior, with what haste and gladness would we put on our cork jackets to work in our turn? Pickaxes sounded on the frozen ice beds. Our arms ached, the skin was torn off our hands. But what were these fatigues? What did the wounds matter? Vital air came to the lungs. We breathed. We breathed. All this time no one prolonged his voluntary task beyond the prescribed time. His task accomplished, each one handed in turn to his panting companions the apparatus that supplied him with life. Captain Nemo set the example, and submitted first to this severe discipline. When the time came, he gave up his apparatus to another, and returned to the vitiated air on board, calm, unflinching, unmurmuring. On that day the ordinary work was accomplished with unusual vigor. Only 2 yards remained to be raised from the surface. 2 yards only separated us from the open sea. But the reservoirs were nearly emptied of air. The little that remained ought to be kept for the workers, not a particle for the Nautilus. When I went back on board I was half suffocated. What a night! I know not how to describe it. The next day my breathing was oppressed. Dizziness accompanied the pain in my head and made me like a drunken man. My companions showed the same symptoms. Some of the crew had rattling in the throat. On that day, the sixth of our imprisonment, Captain Nemo, finding the pickaxes work too slowly, resolved to crush the ice bed that still separated us from the liquid sheet. This man's coolness and energy never forsook him. He subdued his physical pains by moral force. By his orders, the vessel was lightened, that is to say, raised from the ice bed by a change of specific gravity. When it floated, they towed it so as to bring it above the immense trench made on the level of the waterline. Then, filling his reservoirs of water, he descended and shut himself up in the hole. Just then all the crew came on board, and the double door of communication was shut. The Nautilus then rested on the bed of ice, which was not 1 yard thick, and which the sounding leads had perforated in 1,000 places. The taps of the reservoirs were then opened, and 100 cubic yards of water was let in, increasing the weight of the Nautilus to 1,800 tons. We waited. We listened, forgetting our sufferings in hope. Our safety depended on this last chance. Notwithstanding the buzzing in my head, I soon heard the humming sound under the hull of the Nautilus. The ice cracked with a singular noise, like tearing paper, and the Nautilus sank.
"We are off," murmured Conseil in my ear.
I could not answer him. I seized his hand and pressed it convulsively. All at once, carried away by its frightful overcharge, the Nautilus sank like a bullet under the waters. That is to say, it fell as if it was in a vacuum. Then all the electric force was put on the pumps, that soon began to let the water out of the reservoirs. After some minutes, our fall was stopped. Soon, too, the manometer indicated an ascending movement. The screw, going at full speed, made the iron hull tremble to its very bolts, and drew us towards the north. "But if this floating under the iceberg is to last another day before we reach the open sea, I shall be dead first." Half-stretched upon a divan in the library, I was suffocating. My face was purple, my lips blue, my faculties suspended. I neither saw nor heard. All notion of time had gone from my mind. My muscles could not contract. I do not know how many hours passed thus, but I was conscious of the agony that was coming over me. I felt as if I was going to die. Suddenly I came to. Some breaths of air penetrated my lungs. Had we risen to the surface of the waves? Were we free of the iceberg? No. Ned and Conseil, my two brave friends, were sacrificing themselves to save me. Some particles of air still remained at the bottom of one apparatus. Instead of using it, they had kept it for me. And while they were being suffocated, they gave me life, drop by drop. I wanted to push back the thing. They held my hands. And for some moments I breathed freely. I looked at the clock. It was 11 in the morning. It ought to be the 28th of March. The Nautilus went at a frightful pace, 40 miles an hour. It literally tore through the water. Where was Captain Nemo? Had he succumbed? Were his companions dead with him? At the moment, the manometer indicated that we were not more than 20 feet from the surface. A mere plate of ice separated us from the atmosphere. Could we not break it? Perhaps. In any case, the Nautilus was going to attempt it. I felt that it was in an oblique position, lowering the stern and raising the bows. The introduction of water had been the means of distributing its equilibrium. Then, impelled by its powerful screw, it attacked the ice field from beneath like a formidable battering ram. It broke it by backing and then rushing forward against the field, which gradually gave way. And at last, dashing suddenly against it, shot forwards on the ice field, that crushed beneath its weight. The panel was opened, one might say torn off, and the pure air came in abundance to all parts of the Nautilus. Chapter 17. From Cape Horn to the Amazon. How I got onto the platform, I have no idea. Perhaps the Canadian had carried